This is Faster, a podcast by Flow Cycling. In each episode, we interview industry experts to educate you, challenge you, and even change the way you train so you become faster. There are several hundred thousand friction instances per minute in a chain when cycling. This creates a lot of friction and can waste up to 20 watts if your chain is not properly lubricated and maintained. Chain lubrication options have exploded over the last few years, and many people find themselves confused when trying to understand what's best for them. Unfortunately, there's also a lot of bad information around lubrication. Today on Faster, we talk with Adam Karen from Zero Friction Cycling, who's leading the way in cycling lubrication knowledge and testing. We discuss all of the lubrication types and why immersion waxing is best and not as difficult as you may think. Listen to this episode to learn about chain lubrication and how to save up to 30 watts in your next race. When we're not creating this podcast, we're working on other ways to make you faster. At Flow, we design and manufacture some of the world's fastest cycling wheels that we sell consumer direct to keep more money in your pockets. As a special thank you for listening to Faster, we wanted to offer you 20% off your next purchase. Simply use coupon code PODCAST in all capital letters at checkout. Your purchase will also support our give back initiatives. 1% of all sales supports our Bike for a Kid program, where we provide bikes and helmets for kids in need. We also plant one tree for every wheel we ship as a thank you to our planet. Enjoy the show. Adam Karen, welcome to Faster.
Ah, thank you for having me. So, yep, always a pleasure to talk about this fun little area.
Yeah, I know. This is one to me that I have been very interested in over the last few years. My journey with this kind of really started. I remember seeing Ceramic Speed. I think it was probably maybe 2017, 2018 at Kona. And they started like having these dope chains. And I was like, man, there's something interesting there. There's something to that. And I think for me, you know, I'm a mechanical engineer. And one of the things that I've always kind of just scratched my head over is I've ridden a bike quite a bit in my life, not done a ton of racing. But one thing with a drivetrain for me that I always thought of was like, what is the point of doing anything to a chain? And the reason I say that is because I wasn't looking at it from a watt perspective, but I think about it, like, we sell cycling wheels, that's what we do. And I think about if you opened a hub and you exposed the bearing and you exposed it to the elements, within minutes, that hub is going to be gritty and grinding. And so I don't care how many times you clean it or what you do to it. The idea of like throwing a bunch of oil or something on a chain and then riding down the road, I just felt like a waste. So I said, hey, if I'm out training, I'm not really worried about it. It's just adding extra watts to me. So I've looked at it that way. Well, I've been listening to some of your podcasts. I've read some of your stuff. I've really been trying to get into, you know, understanding lubrication in general and what it means. And there's a lot to it that I'm pretty excited about. So I'm very excited to have you on the show. The way I want to look at this podcast, I really want to kind of break it down and just kind of go over all the basics and understanding of what it means. And you are the perfect guest to have on to do that, because you are like the sort of becoming the default standard of everything drivetrain lubrication.
Oh, that would be handy. I've been working, chipping away hard at, you know, trying to get proven information out, as opposed to, because it is very hard for obviously the vast majority of the, you know, racing and just sort of cycling demographic in general to try to work out, you know, from what marketing and you know, sort of all the stuff that's thrown at them saying this is the best, this is the best, this is the best. Really, really tricky to try to work out what is actually a top, you know, product that's going to give them, you know, genuine watt savings and remain low friction. And what's really just, you know, all that's really behind the product is marketing. And really the analogy that you were sort of mentioning before, that's one that I use quite a bit as well, in that because a lot of people just really don't, it doesn't click just how much action is going on in their chain. You know, so bearing, so, you know, it is fairly easy for people to visualize that, okay, if I removed all the bearing seals off my wheel bearings and bottom bracket and went out cycling, how would my wheel bearings be feeling? And, you know, what would the challenge be like to try to keep them silky smooth and low friction and not wearing prematurely due to, you know, grit getting in there? And the challenge with the chain is so much harder. You know, the chain has so many small moving components to it. So every link articulation, there are 8 separate pieces of metal that are sliding on across each other as all the parts of the chain, you know, move. And so you've literally got, for most people cycling around, you're going to have generally easily 200,000 to 300,000 pieces of individual sliding surface friction per minute as you're cycling. And so, you know, even small amounts of change, you know, change into how, you know, how well your lubricant is performing, quickly multiply out to quite a tangible difference. So, you know, lubricant that, you know, might test great in the lab, as soon as you start riding outside and it starts to become contaminated, then you multiply out every, you know, bit more abrasive, you know, contamination that sticks to the chain lubricant and becomes part of that chain lubricant. You multiply that out by 200,000 to 300,000, you know, per minute, then that small change multiplies out to, well, there's a watt. And then pretty soon after that, there's another watt and another watt. And the key message as well that I was trying to drive home is that those increases in you know, losses that you're seeing with your chain performance due to its lubricant becoming more abrasive, that energy, so be it 2, 3, or quite typically sort of around the 5-watt mark versus a, you know, perfectly clean, well-lubricated chain on a good lubricant, that extra energy is literally going into eating through your chain and drivetrain components faster every pedal stroke. So, you know, focusing on your sort of chain and its lubricant is that big low-hanging fruit. It's that great win-win where not only do you save a nice bunch of watts for your cycling and racing, but you're saving that energy going literally into eating through your lovely drivetrain that much faster. So, you know, there are very often great win-wins like that, often with bearings. You know, if you go for that really fast bearing setup, they take a lot more maintenance because you're running a much lighter, faster grease, which needs to be maintained much more regularly. Fast tires tend to puncture more, need to be replaced a lot more. Whereas with the chain, it's the win-win of you save a ton of watts and everything lasts a lot longer. So, yeah, try to drive home that focus.
Yeah. For a guy like this, clearly you have a ton of knowledge. What's your background? Like, how did you even get into this? Where did you come from before you started zero friction cycling?
Yeah, not what most people think, which is fun. So a lot of people automatically assume I'm an engineer or something. So I'm not. I'm actually from a corporate background. So mostly sort of was in a lot of basically process improvement roles. So if you're working for large companies, there's always a lot of systemic issues to resolve. So you have a never-ending work stream there to try to improve things that shouldn't really be running how they're running. It was always going to be myself that was going to have a really fun little just career break, as my wife's a specialist doctor. So when we had our little guy, she would go stir crazy if stay at home, whereas guys, I think, strange nerdy guys like me, we're pretty easily entertained. So we can have a career break and have a bunch of fun. So did that, and really at that time it was really around the time when Friction Facts was brought out by Ceramic Speed, and I felt quite passionately that we really did need to have an independent testing resource in this area, and we sort of had one that had started some awesome pioneering work in this area, and then, you know, we'd sort of lost that independent resource, and I also felt there was so much more to be done because his testing was focused really on outright efficiency of the lubricants, but it didn't really start to sort of touch on what happens with a lubricant once you get outside of the lab and start actually riding with it. So my test, I wanted to take up the torch a bit from where Friction Facts left off, but expand on that work to really get a much sort of deeper understanding of what lubricants really are going to be the best choice for, you know, cyclist X, who's going to be riding either sort of typically dry road, or they're going to be riding, you know, off road, or they ride a lot in the wet. Really trying to get to the bottom of what the best lubricant choices are for that particular person and their, you know, level of maintenance that they're comfortable with. So, which takes a long time. So, but we had to at first come up with a test protocol that was actually going to be able to accurately assess that. And so, you know, that was really, I guess it was great to be able to bounce off and because I'd been sort of pummeling Jason Smith and others with questions for a long time, right from, the start of the Friction Facts days, to really try to get as deep an understanding of this area as I could. And then, so the first part was really to get the best sort of test protocol to try to, you know, nail that down, and then a lot of testing initially to make sure the test actually works. And then actually started building up the test database. And yeah, so it was one of those things that took a long time to really get started, because you just had to get through a lot of sort of hard grinding, you know, sort of work getting through the testing, which takes a long time. It's thousands and thousands of kilometers per test. Building up the data and building up the understanding. And as time's gone on, it's really become obviously sort of a very heavily referenced sort of test database now. And we do get a very, very big picture.
And before we get into, I want to talk about a lot of these things that you're doing, because it's really, really cool. But listening to some of your podcasts, I've been in this space for about probably 10 years, and there's some things that I'm going to ask some very basic questions just so we're all on the same page here moving forward. So let's just start with some drivetrain basics. I know that the main part of the drivetrain that is the biggest watt consumer is going to be the chain, but can you explain all of the components in the drivetrain that can consume watts and that can be improved by lubrication or some type of grease?
Yep, absolutely. So yeah, chains are a nice obvious one, connecting your crank to the back wheel, and that's your most exposed one. But then obviously you've got your main wheel bearings for your front wheel and your back wheel. I separate out the free hub from the back wheel, because the free hub is sort of a separate set of bearings again, which is often overlooked. And people don't, I'll circle back to that to explain a bit more about why the free hub's so important. You've got your bottom bracket, your pulley wheels and your pedals. So they're pretty much your all your bits that are spinning or doing something that needs, you know, it's mechanical action and it needs actual lubrication. Quick circle back to the free hub. It's something that's often overlooked because a lot of people have a misconception that the free hub bearings aren't really that important, that they really only come into play when you're rolling. And in fact, the opposite is true. So obviously your back wheel is affixed to your bike via an axle, which is static. The axle's not turning. It's sort of held fast in the frame. And you've got your back wheel bearings that are turning over spinning over the axle when the back wheel's rolling. Now, when you're not pedaling, your cassette is not turning and the cassette is attached to your free hub. So your free hub is not turning. So your free hub bearings are not, in fact, moving at all when you're rolling. Your free hub bearings are taking your pedaling load. So whatever pedaling force you're putting through your cassette, then obviously the cassette's turning, the free hub's turning now over your static axle. So those bearings are taking your pedaling load. The bearings in the free hub are often quite small due to the sort of size constraints of the free hub. And so they do tend to, go or not, you know, sort of start to give out much faster than your rear wheel's main bearings, and it will start to eat up your pedaling watts. So free hub bearings need a lot more attention more often than your main wheel bearings, and they're often overlooked. So just a quick little dive on free hubs because they're more important than people think.
Do you ever look at pedal bearings at all? Consider that in the equation?
We do it to a point, but a lot of pedal bearings are actually, pedals can be fairly greatly in how easily serviced they are. So some pedals can be, sort of taken apart, replace whatever grease is in there, which is, you know, they're usually typically pretty good greases, but they are designed to last for a pretty good stretch. So you can, in some pedals, fairly easily clean that off and replace them with, say, like a ceramic speed time trial grease, which is going to be a lot quicker. But some pedals really aren't amenable to you sort of playing with them like that. So it really varies quite a lot. So it's something that's typically not, focused on heavily because of that, because results do vary greatly and people can pull their pedals apart and not get them back together very well or the same as before. And whereas other pedals, so for instance, your original speed plays, we had a grease port because they had open bearings, then that was pretty easy. If you're actually maintaining it, you can maintain it with a really fast grease if you want. Some people might have, speed play pedals that are set aside just for racing and they've got time trial grease in them, and then they've got their pedals that they're using for training and use the normal speed play grease. So varies quite a bit. And then people that forget to re-grease their speed play pedals and end up with seized bearings have a different experience. So
If we look at all those components, then let's say we take a look at the, you talk about the chain, bottom bracket bearings, you got the pulley wheels, you've got the wheel bearings, and then you got the free hub bearings. If you were to take a percentage of drivetrain loss, so obviously the chain being the largest percentage, maybe it's 70%, how would you break the percentages up over all of those when consuming watts?
Yeah, so percentage-wise, so a bit of a breakdown, and this is assuming things are running really well. So this would be like a bike that has been sort of either basically pretty new and everything's running sweet and it's got good bearings in it and everything's going as we'd like. So let's say you've got a chain with a good lubricant on it as well, so the factory grease is cleaned on off, replaced with a good lube. We'll call the chain, say, 5 watts. Wheel bearings about 5 watts. Free hub around 1 watt. Bottom bracket about 1 watt. Pulley 0.1 watt. Pedals about 1 watt. So you're totaling about 13.1 watts of drivetrain friction if things are sort of generally running really well. And so this means that the chain's going to be about 38%. Your front and rear wheel bearings about 38%. Bottom bracket's about 8%. Pulleys under 1%, pedals around 8%, and there's a little bit of sort of just rounding errors to make up the total to 100. And so, yeah, I think the next question I think we're looking at was, worst case scenarios. Now, that can get pretty bad, and also fully optimized things can look pretty amazing. So you can fully optimize a drivetrain. So you could sort of get your chain down to around the 3-watt mark, your wheel bearings down to around 3 watts, bottom brackets can easily be down to around 0.3 watt, pulleys almost basically negligible, so nearly zero, pedals about 0.2 watts. So you can easily get sort of in the around the 6.5, so call it a 6 to 7 watt drivetrain. And worst case, if you didn't have any lubrication and your bearings had gone to not very well. And this is being conservative on some of the bearing numbers because we don't have a lot of actual real data on this. So we've got sort of conservative numbers. But chains, we do have data. So chains without any lubrication, you're looking at easily 20 watts, can be up to 25 watts, which is, again, the chain's the big one because it's just got so many moving parts. So, and those little parts are under such high load. So that goes pretty badly, pretty quickly if you don't look after it. Wheel bearings. So bearings won't generally go as catastrophically bad as your chain, but easily you can get wheel bearings that'll sort of double from sort of that 5 to 10 watt. Your free hub bearings can easily get up to around 3. Bottom bracket around 3. Pedals up to around 3. It's a bit of a larger increase versus percentage wise than what you get with other bearings, just because of the nature of the sinusoidal loading that you get on pedals. You got very high peak loading, so if your bearings aren't going great in there, that will really come back to bite. Pulleys can get to a watt, and so easily you can have a drivetrain. Worst case, like let's say somebody's not lubed their chain and it's squeaking away. Those chains you hear from 50 meters away when you're coming up on a cyclist, and bearings that are just running, either completely dry and rough or they're just starting to fail. So you got bits of bearing cage and everything in there, stuff like that. So if everything had gone to crap, which is rare, but every now and then you might find one, that then the total of all of what I ran through there is basically like sort of 40 watts. So worst case, if everything on the bike has gone to crap, then you look at sort of 40 watts versus fully optimized at about 6.5 watts. So
you're looking at 33.5 watts, basically. In theory, you could be losing. And even you said even a good setup, right? I mean, when you start talking about 13 to 14 watts down to 6 to 7, that's a considerable difference. But when you're not maintaining, if you're just showing up at a race and you haven't done the work, I mean, you could be losing 30 plus watts. That's a massive, massive.
Yeah, most races won't let things get like the worst case scenario, but you will see a lot where, quite easily a lot of people will be going around, around the sort of 20 watt loss mark as opposed to where they should at least be, which is around that 12. Ish watt mark. So it's quite often when I had the workshop site open, which I haven't had open this year because just been completely flat out with both the testing and retail side. So, but it was really frequent where local customers, especially local racing customers, they're like, right, that's it. It's time to get onto, it's time for a new chain, and I want the new one to get onto immersive waxing because it all clicks as to why that's a lot better. And so they you know, drop the bike off and you pop their old chain off, ready to clean the drivetrain and check everything before you put the new wax chain on, and you pop the chain off and it's like, oh man, that bottom bracket is, that is just done. Like, it feels like a bottom bracket that Fred Flintstone would have made. You know, the rear wheel bearings, you spin the wheel and hold the axle, and it's like, okay, they're feeling really rough and notchy and dry. We got a, you know, pulley wheel that's really hard to turn, and it's like, my goodness, how many races has this person been doing on this? And you know, wondering why the race season is sort of struggling a bit this year. So, you know, one of the things when people are obviously just this is one of the benefits of immersive waxing, apart from what you get there, is that, you know, because you're popping the chain off all the time to re-wax it, then you get to do a very quick check of everything and make sure that everything is spinning silky smooth and free. So you always know that your drivetrain is going as it should be, and you're able to get onto things very quickly as soon as something starts to feel or sound not quite right. Whereas, yeah, if you're always obviously just dripping lube on a chain and never take your chain off for some periodic maintenance, you don't know what's going on. You will not feel if your bottom bracket has gone from half a watt to 2 watts. You will not feel if a pulley wheel is not really turning great, or if your back wheels are starting to go. So, yeah, a lot of that gets missed. And so time and time and time again, you'd pop a chain off to switch things over, or just, even if they're not waxing, just going to a new chain and some maintenance. And as soon as you pop it off, it's like, whoa, whole bunch of stuff going on here. So, so a lot of people will be much higher than they should be.
Let me ask you this. So I want to get into some lubrication basics, because I think it gets really confusing really quickly. There's been so many things that have come out in the last few years. I remember growing up as a kid, my dad had like this little metal tin with a nozzle on it that you, every once in a while, you'd put new chain lube on your chain. That was it, right? Today we have things like waxes. We've got, you know, I know Silke has something called super secret chain lube. There's things that have different type of additives in them. Can you just define what the different types of, or I guess categories of lubricants can be? We have oil, we have wax. What are those categories and how would you break those down?
Yeah, so roughly, like, there are quite a lot. So still keeping things broadly, we'll call it, say, immersive waxes. Wax emulsion lubricants, which is basically a wax that is typically in, say, a water carrier. So that's, say, like your squirt is probably a well-known one. What I term your chain coating type lubricants. So that's, say, like your Silke SS Drip or UFO Drip, which are trying to imitate immersive waxing in a bottle. So they're actually set to a true solid as opposed to a semi sort of, you know, or half solid like a squirt. Wet lubricants, of which there's a massive variance in wet lubricants. Dry lubes, you've got aerosol lubes, you've got ceramic lubricants, so-called nano lubes, and you've got, there's one at least rub-on wax type, which is an interesting way to go. So just off the top of my head, we've got some sort of broad categories there, but within those you've also got quite a variance of subcategories across a lot. So there's tons.
So there's wets, there's dries, there's waxes, there's immersions, and then there's sort of like a UFO drip type option. So if we break it down to those five categories, that's pretty accurate.
Yep, and probably aerosol, I guess, is a broad category you'd probably throw aerosol on as well.
Okay. So of all the lubricants that you deal with, which are the ones that are most important? Are some for like, you know, a $100 Walmart bike, and some are for like, a brand new Trek Madone? Like, what are the categories of lubricants that you're really concerned with?
Most of the ones, I guess zero friction cycling has become a little bit synonymous with immersive waxing, which whilst immersive waxing is the number one recommended, you know, option for those that can sort of get their head around that, which it's a lot easier than most will think. Aside from that, though, really what, you know, the main question I'm often asked is, you know, what makes a great lubricant? And really what makes a great lubricant is a lubricant that is going to stay, you know, I guess going to resist contamination for as long as possible in the type of cycling that you're doing. And I guess, you know, whilst one may say, look, you don't need to worry too much if you're just buying a Walmart bike versus a, you know, a Top Trek bike, really depends on, you know, if you're going to actually use it. Remember that cheap parts don't have really any hardening or wear resistant treatments on them. So if you're running just a meh lube with no maintenance, then those parts are going to go to crap pretty quickly, and then the bike's not really going to be very nice to ride at all. So yeah, it really depends on if somebody wants to basically just keep their drivetrain silky smooth, really low wear, and not a gunky mess, then even a fairly small focus on that area will keep things pretty nice. So there are some really great, for instance, wet lubricants that if you just tend to use that bike riding around town, so you're typically just riding on the road, then there are some great wet lubricant choices that you really don't have to do a lot to at all to keep them running magnificently. And because you're not going to expect someone with a Walmart bike to necessarily start immersive waxing.
So when you talk immersive, when you say immersive waxing, are you talking like a crock pot with a wax? What is your definition of immersive waxing?
Yeah, so that's definitely it. So it's basically a wax that you're going to melt in a pot, and that should be a crock pot or a slow cooker. And yeah, you're just popping the chain off the bike, popping into the pot, and turning the pot on. You just come back whenever later when it's melted and swish it around. You hang that for the wax to set. It'll set to basically like a bit solid, like you could almost sort of hold your chain out straight. And then so you just break the what's called the wax bond on the links, reinstall the chain, and off you go. So sounds like a bunch of work, but it's honestly, it's really for most about 4 to 5 minutes of total actual labor time, because you don't have to stand there and watch the wax melt. And so you've got a few minutes more at the front end versus, say, just dripping more lube on and wiping the chain. But the benefit of immersive waxing, aside from the fact that they're super fast and being obviously a solid, that they have the highest level contamination resistance, the great advantage really is at the back end, because you just don't have really any maintenance. You just pop the chain off and re-wax it, and that just resets whatever contamination is in your chain, and you're back to basically near zero again for your next coating. And you don't have to clean your chain, you don't have to do any drivetrain cleaning maintenance. So depending on your cycling, if you're riding and finding that every sort of week or a couple of weeks or once a month you're out there with a bunch of solvents and degreasers and trying to clean your, you're continually sort of fighting this black mess, then, quite quickly the timetables turn on, immersive waxing being actually much more time efficient versus trying to keep on top of a drip lube chain. So
I'll be completely honest here. That's one of the reasons when I was, when I was originally, riding a lot and looking at chains and trying to figure everything out. I live in Las Vegas, and one of the things about Las Vegas is we don't get a lot of rain. And so what that means is that there's a lot of oil buildup and stuff that stays on the road surface.
Yeah.
So when you're riding down the road, cleaning a chain is like, it's like you're pulling on a string that's never ending.
Yes.
I don't care how much you put on it. It just keeps coming, more and more black comes off. So it's like, how do I actually properly clean a chain?
Yeah, that's right. And that's where people don't quite realize just, how much that it actually takes to properly keep it clean. So, and there's a lot of lubricants that claim that they clean as they lubricate, and really they don't do that to any sort of real degree at all. So if you were to take most wet lubricant chains, and I've got a couple of videos started now on, I just started a YouTube channel. So I've taken just a typical customer's chain that's done a few thousand kilometers and shown what's needed to solvent flush clean that chain. And it is just liters and liters of solvent. So you pop the chain off and you put it in, and the first container of a few hundred mil of solvent is going to go black within 10 seconds. And so then you pour that out, wipe the chain, wipe container, go again, and it just goes black again and again and again. And about 10 bars later, it's sort of starting to go to a lighter gray, and sort of somewhere around about 3 to 4 liters of solvent, you'll start to get the solvent coming out more or less as clean as what it went in. So, it's a lot to reset properly a drip loop chain. And so if you think about, what's happening when you just sort of add more lubrication over your existing, chain. So let's say you've got a wet lube and you put a really heavy application of that wet lube on, let's call it a 10 mil application. That's still across, a chain that's over 100 links, that's basically less than 0.1 mil per link. So there's not a lot of flush cleaning that you're going to get with you know, even a very heavy application, all you're doing really is improving the ratio of lubricant to contamination in your chain. And that's just a ratio that's going to continue to degrade as you just sort of ride after ride, keep adding lube and wiping chain. So, yeah, a lot of, especially trying to maintain a lot of wet lubricants, if you actually wanted to keep that chain really low friction day in, day out, the amount of, you know, cost and time you would have in removing the chain and doing solvent flush cleans to reset it would be quite enormous. Whereas obviously if you've got the top lubricants that either A, stay a lot cleaner for a lot longer, or B, with immersive waxing, it's just reset back to basically, you know, near zero contamination every time, it pretty quickly works out as, you know, yeah, better options are just a lot better.
So this is really interesting to me. So you've got all the different types. So wet lubes, and this is, you know, I've always traditionally used a wet lube, and that's, like I say, it's the one that's, it's very difficult to work with. When you look at the other types of lubricants, you know, I guess we're sort of starting to talk about some of the pros and cons of each type. I'm not seeing a ton of pros to a wet lube. If we look at like a dry lube, even like a UFO, like a drip-on, any of those, which ones are really good at like resisting contamination, and which ones sort of just attract contamination of the different lubrication types?
Yeah, so this is going to depend a little bit on your cycling. So, I mean, there are some really good wet lubes, so but they tackle the, I guess, that issue via a very specific method. So if I take, probably the best example would be, say, Silka Synergetic. So that, you know, has a needle applicator. You need so little, you know, lubricant to provide brilliant lubrication inside your chain. And what you want, obviously, is an amazing lubricant inside your chain. And if it's a wet lubricant, you want as little as possible of that lubricant outside your chain. Where, because if it's a wet lubricant, every particle of airborne dust and contamination is going to stick on contact. That's just the trade-off with wet lubricants. So with a lubricant like Silka Synergetic, you know, quite deliberately, apart from obviously making, I guess, a lubricant that's designed to be, you know, specifically amazing for a bicycle chain lubricant, because a lot of lubricants on the market are not that. They are rebottled lubricants from other industries, just rebranded by a cycling brand and pumped out as a chain lube. So they're not designed specifically to work as a brilliant lube for a bicycle chain, whereas, you know, some companies do make lubricants ground up for that. And so it's got that, but obviously the secret really is that so little of it is needed that once you've applied it, done it, you know, worked the lubricant in, wiped all the excess, although it's a wet lube chain, it is much, much less wet than, you know, most other wet lubricants, which means it's going to get contaminated much more slowly, and your maintenance of that is going to be a lot, you know, it's one, it's going to be a lot less frequent, and two, it's going to be a lot easier. So when you look at, and I'll just, I guess, one particular example that I really, to contrast that, which shows the exact, you know, is the exact wrong thing you should ever do. So Muckoff, a number of their lubricants have UV-infused particles, and they come with a UV light, so that you can make sure that all of your chain is completely coated in a wet lubricant, which is obviously the absolute worst way you would ever want to approach the, you know, the thing. If you're running with a wet lube, why on earth would you want to make all of the outside of your chain covered in a wet lube? It's going to end up in a, obviously, a black mess, contamination, abrasive disaster, which is exactly what happens. So if you're going to run a wet lubricant, then you really want to choose one that is going to, you know, be at the least wet possible while still providing excellent lubrication. Now, this is where sometimes we get the crossover into what we'll call your traditional dry lubricants. So we'll say your Finish Line dry, your Muckoff dry, that sort of stuff. And they work by basically being mostly carrier that evaporates off, leaving a chain that looks quite clean. The trouble with those type of lubricants is that they have so little actual lubrication in them that really, unless you're putting about half a bottle through every reapplication, you've got about, you know, effectively, you know, 40 to 60 kilometers of, you know, possibly of actual lubrication in your chain before your that treatment is done. And so you typically see very high wear rates with your traditional dry lubricants, even though the chain looks really clean. So it's kind of one of those cases where the beauty is really only skin deep. So what's happening inside is really not great. There's just not very good lubrication happening inside. So this is, you know, really where that, you know, genuine top lubricants, you know, taking care of all those parts inside your chain, working so hard, completely exposed to contamination, makes such a huge difference versus lubricants that are really doing a poor job. So, and yeah, I guess lastly on that, probably the biggest mismatch that we see. So whilst I say there are some really top wet lubricants like, say, Synergetic, it is absolutely a mismatch of product use to use a wet lubricant and off-road. You know, you just, why would you take a wet lubricant out into the world of dirt and dust? Because you cannot get past the fact that every particle of dust is going to stick on contact. So, and that's probably the biggest demographic. I'd say probably 90% plus of mountain bike riders and gravel riders are running a wet lube for this, you know, the apparent longevity per treatment. But it's just, yeah, it is a mismatch of product type to use case.
Yeah, it's like going to the beach and getting in the water and then try to walk back to the car and barefoot without getting sand on your feet.
Exactly.
Like, I mean, it just doesn't make any sense, right?
No, but it's amazing how many in that demographic, though. It's just because it's just the done thing. It's been done since forever. You you know, you drip some lube on and then you drip some more lube on and you know, wipe chain and go again. And yeah, so you do see some pretty you know, I guess horrific sort of wear rates for those using, you know, not great, especially if they're really pretty average sort of wet lubes out in the world of dirt and dust. And that's starting to change, not so much because they're sort of thinking about friction. A lot of mountain bikers and so on don't really think about friction because then a lot of them aren't racing, they're just going out there for recreation. But what's really starting to finally drive the change in that demographic is the cost of parts. So, you know, a lot of the 12-speed gear is just really not cheap, and people are starting to think, oh man, I really probably should make my $800 cassette last a bit longer than that, or even my $500 cassette. So, and you know, chains can be well over $100, you know, even up to sort of $170, $180 Australian. So yeah, do you want to burn through that, or would you prefer to have that last 3 to 5 to even 10 times as long versus a, you know, a poor to random lubricant choice, which is literally the difference between the top stuff and the, you know, average to poor stuff. So that's starting to have an impact on that side. But yeah, wherever possible, I've been trying to sort of hammer the message home that wet lubricants and off-road, not the greatest. No, there are a lot of other options. You don't have to immersive wax. If immersive waxing isn't for you, then there are a bunch of other great options for, you know, going out into the world of dirt and dust, other than wet lubricants.
Okay, making a ton of sense. You're breaking this down in a really, really great way. So the only one I'm still want to kind of clarify is you've got stuff like the, you know, immersion type, crock pot, you know, there's different blends. I know there's all kinds of people that, some people just talk about using paraffin, people use whatever else, but there's also things like UFO or Silka super secret chain lube. Those are, I guess they're wax based drip lubricants. What is the difference and why would you pick one over the other when you're looking at an immersion like crock pot versus one of these like UFO or drip treatments?
Yeah. So most people will pick the UFO or the super secret drip versus immersive waxing because they're just not confident, or it's just not for them to remove their chain and put it, you know, into a bath of wax. So it's one of those things where literally immersive waxing, I can break down to three main categories of people. People that see it and instantly click as to why that's going to be so much better for them and they can't wait to get onto it. Second is a bit of a slow burn. They see it and they think, yep, I get it, but is that going to be for me? Can I get around popping my chain off all the time to re-wax? And really the third is like, that's batshit crazy. I'm never going to, you know, be popping my chain off and putting it in a pot and melting wax. Are you kidding me? So your next best for most, especially for off-road, is going to be your super secret or UFO, so these are your really high-end wax-based lubricants where they use basically the same super, you know, wax base as your top immersive waxes, but they've, you know, managed to put them into a carrier which does actually fully evaporate and you're left with a solid coating. Now versus immersive waxing, I guess the downside of that convenience is that you're basically putting half the amount of, you know, coating on, because half of what you're applying is a carrier. So the treatment lifespan for those lubricants is going to be shorter versus an immersive wax. And, you know, whilst they are extremely contamination resistant, they're basically the next you know, highest obviously contamination resistance as after immersive waxing, is that some level of contamination over time is inevitable. And you are, if you're not doing any maintenance, then you are going to be applying, you know, more lubricant over the top of a chain that has some level of contamination into it, and that is going to build up slowly over time, depending on your type of riding. The other benefit, though, to those, I guess your next best choice of those lubricants is that they're, being the type of wax base they are extremely easy to reset the contamination. So your top immersive waxes like Molten Speed Wax and Hot Melt, and then the Silka Super Secret and UFO is your top chain coating lubricants. You can literally, you can't do a perfect, but you can do a great reset with just boiling water, because that wax base will actually just mostly just melt off. So for most of you, just your general riding maintenance, if it's your, especially if it's just your training chain, you can do a brilliant reset of contamination with just some boiling water, flush rinses, dry it, and then, you know, reapply the lube or re-wax. So, you know, and as a long-term, you know, sort of person myself in that sort of camp, is that, you know, I can do a full mudder CX race or full mudder, you know, mountain bike ride or race. And I'm not sure if you know, like whenever you've, say, you might have finished a particular ride or event, or you're doing some maintenance of your drip lube chain, and you do that first solvent bath clean and you pull the chain out, and you just feel and hear all that grit in your chain after you've done that first solvent bath. And it's like, oh man, that, there's some stuff going on in this chain that was pretty exciting. When you when you do it with a, you know, so the, I guess those on, say, the immersive wax and those you know, UFO and so on, when you finish a full mudder ride and you've done a few, you know, quick baths in boiling water, and you pull the chain out and you're wiping it dry, and it feels silky smooth. You know, it's like, wow, I've just used boiling water and my chain feels amazing. Again, there are extra steps we do if it's your dedicated race chain to make sure it's reset back to, you know, absolutely perfect. But just your training chain, it's like, it's just so, so easy to do that, and you're not having to go through the cost of solvents. And then again, with solvents, how are they being disposed? They're usually not disposed super well. So there's some real advantages to those, you know, sort of top waxes, be it immersive or the chain coating type. So the trade-off with especially, I guess, your, say, your UFO and your Super Secret is, I guess, that's sort of slightly shorter treatment lifespan. So because you're half of what you're applying is carrier, and that type of wax is just not as long lasting as other types of waxes like a squirt or a smooth. It's a different type of wax base. It's not as long lasting per treatment. It will last the treatment lifespan of most events no problems, unless it's really wet and harsh conditions, but you do need to apply them more frequently than other lubricant types. So there's pros and cons, you know, always with these things, but you know, to me, the pros will outweigh the cons for those lubricants over other options. So,
you know, one thing I heard you say in another podcast. Yeah, I agree. And one thing I heard you say in another podcast, which I 100% agree with, is the idea of taking your chain off and learning how to do that is just like changing a tire, right? Like it's something that really is, the first time you do it, it's like you're trying to wrap your head around, like, oh my gosh, there's so many moving parts, and where does this part go, and how does it wrap around? But once you do it a few times, it's actually a really simple thing. And from a bike maintenance perspective, you know, with an immersion type lubricant being obviously ideal in this situation, and then, the like you're saying, you put this in the crock pot and you're not really having to clean it, because you're basically recoating, because it takes away prevents any of the contamination. You're really saving yourself a ton of time and a ton of money if you're able to preserve the drivetrain. So tons of pros. I guess the only con you could potentially look at is if you don't know how to take your chain off. But once you get past that hurdle, it seems pretty like much like a no-brainer to be using some type of immersion.
Absolutely. Yeah, for those that sort of can get their head around that, so those in sort of either camp A or camp B that I ran through before, then absolutely they will have the cleanest, lowest friction, longest lasting drivetrain that they will, you know, ever have by, you know, a fair margin, versus if they were just using, you know, whatever random wet lube choice before. And especially if you ride a fair bit and you're running some, you know, sort of reasonably, you know, decent sort of tier group set, the cost to run savings, you know, sort of say per 10,000 kilometers, they're quite big. So I've got the cost to run modeling on the website as part of the lubricant testing where, you know, after I've fully tested the lubricant, you know, we're looking at, okay, so, you know, what's the cost of the lubricant? What's the, you know, the use rate of the lubricant? So we get the sort of the lubricant cost per 10,000 kilometres, as well as then factoring in the wear rates of the chain, the cassette and the chain ring. And then we can sort of, you know, obviously model out what it's costing you to run using that lubricant in these, you know, various types of cycling conditions and group sets. And quite often it's, you know, it's for the top lubricants versus even, you know, sort of decent lubricants, the savings can be well over $1,000 per year. And versus your average lubricants, if you're, you know, per 10,000 kilometres, it can be, you know, well over $2,000. So literally for just something as simple as focusing on your lubricant choice and maintenance, that can be the difference every 10,000 kilometres on, did you want to spend that money on that, you know, new glasses, helmet, cycling kit, shoes, or did you want to spend it burning through your drivetrain components faster? And I can assure you that, you know, the first option is a lot more fun than, and you know, just burning on through drivetrain. So yeah, just that little bit of focus on that area.
Last question on lubrication, I think, is if you look at the different types of waxes, a lot of them are using additives. I know like tungsten disulfide, the wax bases. Can you talk a little bit about the additives that are used, the types of actual waxes that are used, and can you also touch on and how waxes and things like that, are they environmentally friendly or are they actually sort of, do they contaminate as they're used? How does that look?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's one that's coming up more and more, which is excellent. So more and more customers or cycling consumers are looking at, you know, what is in the lubricant that they're putting on the chain, and that's great. So, and a lot of the main, I guess, players in this area have sort of, you know, really been at the sort of forefront of knowing that trend is happening and taking a lot of care with what they're using for their lubricant bases and additives, that they're not going to have a, you know, very high toxicity. So even things that I guess are, you know, inert, so to speak, like PTFE, that's inert in and of itself, but it's quite, you know, environmentally not great to manufacture it. So a lot of the top lubricants have really gone down the path of removing PTFE from their lubricant and replacing it with other additives like tungsten disulfide. A lot of the top lubricants now, like say your Hot Melt and your Silka Lubes, Molten Speed Wax, UFO, they're very, very, very environmentally friendly. They're pretty much, you know, claim to be basically 100% environmentally friendly lubricants, and they've removed PTFE completely from their blends. And the wax blends themselves are basically a really pretty high tech mix of you know, paraffin and some other, you know, non toxic waxes. And this is where, without rambling too much, I'll touch quickly on, because DIY waxing comes up a lot, and I mean a lot. I get countless emails read DIY waxing, because there's so much info out there on various YouTube channels and forums about that. People go wrong a lot with DIY waxing by buying a cheap paraffin, either hardware paraffin or paraffin off eBay, and it will not be a great wax because it has a very high mineral oil content, so it will get gunky and dirty quite quickly, and it will not be fast. Candles are terrible. Do not use candles. We see this all the time. I saw one recently where one triathlete coach was using one candle to melt another candle over his chain. And, you know, a lot of people, you read the comments and everyone's like, oh, that's amazing. You know, it's the good heavens. So, you know, candles, apart from not being obviously a very fast base wax, they've also got other impurities like palm oil and soy. So now with the waxes, even with, say, if we take Molten Speed Wax, which has obviously started off being, at the start of the Friction Facts days, that was the fastest product and it's a great product. And even now, its latest blend is basically, it's faster and it's twice as long lasting per treatment as what the original blend was back in the day. So they've refined that a lot over time. And Hot Melt is sort of obviously stepped in to be, you know, also an amazing immersive wax. You know, what's behind these waxes is just a huge amount of research and development, you know, enormous amount, and testing that goes on for years. You will not DIY wax your way anywhere near what these products are. You can get a good wax if you use a great base. So if you don't skimp on the base wax, so if you buy, say, a food grade or canning wax, you will get a lubricant or a wax that will beat, I guess, a lot of the just the meh stuff that you get off a, off the shelf, but you will still not come within the same city as the ballpark, you know, that the top immersive waxes are in. So
you may not be in the ballpark, but you might get like a nice apple cinnamon or like
that's right.
spice smell when you're riding yes. your bike if you use candles,
something like that.
You know,
yeah. So yeah, people can do an okay job, like, but they won't get anywhere near the top stuff. So just for the DIY okay. waxes, I don't want to break the DIY waxes' hearts, but it's one of those areas where
it's okay.
Yeah, it's one of those things where, like, as you know, obviously I'm an avid tinkerer, and there are a lot of cyclists who are avid tinkerers, and they think, you know what, I don't need to go and pay the, you know, this name brand stuff. I can make my own. But in reality, the difference in, you know, the performance and the wear rate still, you know, my view is you should be DIY, you know, your chain lube to the same extent as you should be DIY doing your engine oil. Because for a lot of people, if you're running, you know, Axis Road or, you know, similar price group sets, the cost to run difference isn't going to be that much difference than if you sort of ran a pretty average, you know, oil in your engine. So that's my sort of advice, is that what's behind the top lubricants, it's not just fluff. In the cases of the manufacturers putting out genuinely great stuff that's been, I guess, tested and proven to be pretty amazing stuff. So you won't match it. And yeah, so that's on that part. Now I've lost my thread on what the actual question was covering that point, but so just here, circle me back. Yes, right. So, yep. The additive. So, yeah, yep. Yeah, so I guess the main drive, I guess, on that is that, and this is part of why I still sort of tend to recommend that with the top immersive wax or chain coating products, is because, one, you do have that great contamination resistance because they're basically solid, and two, they're so easily cleaned without needing to use solvents. So, probably the other big misconception that we're trying to battle a lot is that, you know, if you ride a lot in the wet, then you should be running a wet lube, that, you know, a wax lube or an immersive waxing is not suitable. And it's really just, again, it's a different way of doing things. So if you ride in the wet, you have to pay the piper one of two ways, because no matter what you're running, the water is going to run right through your chain, and it's going to bring a whole bunch of contamination in with it, and it's going to be pressed into whatever lubricant you're running, because of there's, you know, super high pressures inside your chain from pedaling load. So whatever contamination is brought into your chain by the water, which is a great transport medium, it is going to become part of your lubricant. And so post-wet cycling, you have to pay the piper in one of two ways. One, you know, some maintenance to reset the contamination in that chain, or two, you're going to pay it in friction and wear if you don't do that. So if you ride a lot in the wet, your best lubricant choice is going to be one that is the easiest reset after wet cycling. And again, nothing is easier than popping your chain off and putting it on a pot and turning the pot from off to low. That is easier than flushing liters of solvent through your chain. And then again, where's all that solvent ending up? And if people think, man, I can't, you know, I ride every day and it's often wet every day, I can't ride, you know, I can't re-wax every day, then again, there's easy workarounds for that. Just run multiple chains. So everyone's going to need to buy a new chain sooner or later, and if you're riding a lot in the wet, that next new chain really is not that far away. So pre-buying your next chain or two costs you no more, and now it enables you to pop your chain off one day, wrap it in a microfiber cloth, and it's going to be fine for, you know, a week. Pop your next chain on, do the same again post the next wet ride, do the same again on your, you know, if you're running three chains, and then just re-wax all three at once. Nothing is easier than that, and then you're guaranteeing that you're going to get two or three chains through your cassette as opposed to just one. So you get the savings of ensuring that, because if you're riding frequently in the wet, you're going to rip through your, you know, recommended replacement mark quite, you know, usually before you've realized, and you're going to have to replace the cassette every time you replace the chain and make pretty good inroads in your chain rings as well. So going to that type of system, it is just so much easier. If you're riding day in, day out, you know, intrepid commuter or trainer in harsh wet conditions, multiple chains with immersive waxing, I can promise you there's nothing easier than that to keep your drivetrain, you know, nice and slippery. So, and environmentally, vastly better.
Yeah. And one thing here that we deal with a lot, you know, especially we look at it from a wheel perspective, especially in places where there's there's snow. You've got two snow control methods. You've either got salt or you've got sand. Sand is just brutal for rim brakes. I mean, you just tear through wheels, right? Because it gets wet, it sticks on, it's like sandpaper. And then you've got salt, which is not so bad as long as it's melted, right? As long as it's dissolved into the snow. I'm assuming an immersion type wax in winter is really, really good too, because it prevents that contamination.
Yeah, so basically one of the things where people get caught out with the wax is that the wax gets abraded off the outside of the rollers first. Your rollers are a high carbon steel for hardness, and high carbon steels do oxidize very easily. So if you ride on, you know, wet or especially wet salted roads with a immersive wax chain or a lot of the chain coating wax lubricants, and then you park your bike at the end of the day and come back the next morning, you'll start to see some spot rusting occurring on your rollers. And so, again, people think, this just isn't suitable for my type of riding. I need to slather on some, really sort of wet conditions, wet lubricant. And so it's just understanding, the limitations of the lubricant on that side. So it is literally, if you ride in the wet, then you need to remove the chain, just wipe it dry and wrap it in a dry cloth. And then you're okay for it to sit there for a bit until you're going to do your re-wax, if you're not re-waxing at the end of that day. Yes, you can run, a heavy wet lubricant that's designed to run in extreme conditions. And it's one of these things where what you may choose to last for, say, a particular really long, harsh conditions event may differ versus what you're going to use for your day-to-day riding and training, because it's like, okay, maybe this UFO will super secret. Maybe it's not going to last a four-hour, wet, harsh conditions event. But your immersive waxes, unless it's super harsh, they will be fine because, it's 100% lubricant as opposed to half bean carrier. But if it's really long, you might need to go with a lubricant choice that is going to stay stuck. It's not going to get abraded off from that contamination. It's stuck to your chain. Yes, it's going to get heavily contaminated, but you're still going to have lubrication there to get you through that particular event. But you just have to know that, unless you do something with that chain, as in completely solvent flush clean and reset it, your next ride in the sun from a friction and wear perspective is still going to be the same as if you're riding in the wet, because that contamination hasn't gone anywhere. And adding 0.1 mil per link of lubricant over the top of your old coating isn't going to really help things a lot. So it's sort of, understanding just, limitations that you can't just ride your wax chain usually and park it and not have your chain start to oxidize or rust over a period of a day or two. Whereas a lot of wet lubricants, you can park your bike and everything seemingly is fine, but you got to know what's going on inside. And just with the other option, okay, it's cool. I know what I have to do. All I got to do is just pop the chain off, stick it in my pot, or wrap it up in a cloth, and I'm good. So that's the sort of the things to really, people to ponder as to what their choice is.
Cool. Let's talk about some drivetrain care and maintenance. I want to kind of go over this because I just want people to understand, some basics. A lot of times you hear people getting a new chain and you hear the term breaking a chain in. What does it mean to break in a chain? How do you do that?
Yeah, so break a chain is actually just basically a ride with the factory grease on. So in most cases, obviously, the message has always been the first thing you should do is remove the factory grease and replace it with a top known lubricant. But if you're making, now chain breaking really is only for those that are going down the path of looking to do a fully optimized race chain. So there, from manufacture, there are going to be some tiny bits of metal left over from the manufacture. And, the surfaces aren't quite, perfect, so to speak. And so you can actually improve that a bit by doing a break-in ride with the factory grease and then doing a really good clean post that break-in ride to get, the factory grease is then really going to transport out any of the tiny little bits of metal that are left in there from manufacture, and the surface is going to be improved a little bit. So now the mistake, though, is there's a lot of misinformation about what a break-in should be. Like I've seen on one YouTube video, it's got, you should ride the chain for 400 kilometres. That's going to be really bad. If you ride for 400 kilometres outside with the factory grease, you will have done quite a bit of damage to the surface of your chain, and the low friction coating on the chain will already be quite compromised. So if you're going to do a break-in, it should be absolutely indoors on your ergo, and it's generally a lot shorter than you think. I can't give exact timings and loadings, because this is where some of the proprietary knowledge comes in with those of us that do optimized chains. I can say, though, that in general, some chain brands are a lot tighter than others. So Shimano chains, for instance, come in, especially their road chains, come in very much almost like a sort of pre-broken in state. So your Shimano road chains need quite a short break in. Other chains, which I will call sort of normal tolerances, like your Campy, your YBN, and so on, will need just a medium length break in. And then SRAM tend to run really tight tolerances, especially between the roller and the inner plate shoulders. And so your SRAM chains need a longer break in. But indoors, clean conditions, don't do it outside. And I do actually have a race chain and ultrasonic guide. And if you are going to go down the path of doing a break-in because you want to do an optimized chain, then it does definitely help if you do have an ultrasonic in that case. So really, for 99% of riders, you never have to worry about, should I need an ultrasonic? But if you're getting into the, I want to do a fully optimized race chain myself, then having a read of that to see, should I get an ultrasonic, is that going to be for me because I want to step down that path, then that guide will help you decide if you need to buy one or not. So
ultrasonic, break that down for us. What's the difference between immersion and ultrasonic?
So an ultrasonic, it is immersion. An ultrasonic basically works by cavitation. So you've got the ultrasonic frequency waves through the solution create billions of imploding bubbles, which causes a scrubbing action on the chain. Now, so a lot of people that go down the ultrasonic path don't do it properly at all because they degas the solution. If you've got gas in or air, so if you have a bubbler in a fish tank, that's oxygenating the water in the fish tank so the fish can breathe. So that water is basically aerated. If you've got gas in your solution, which will happen when you pour it into the ultrasonic tank, the gas will fill the bubbles that are trying to implode, and you don't have any imploding bubbles and you don't have any scrubbing action. So you need a degas run. How long that is will depend a bit on the solution, because different solutions absorb different rates of gas when you pour it in. And then you also need to have the right power. So like everything, there's the right tool for the job. So a watchmaker generally doesn't have a lot of use for a 4-pound hammer, and a construction worker usually doesn't have a lot of use for a watchmaker's hammer. So a lot of the cheap ultrasonics have a very low ultrasonic cleaning power per liter. So they look like they're good. They've got sort of maybe a good claimed ultrasonic power, but they might be a 6-liter ultrasonic tank, which is way bigger than what you obviously sort of want or need for a chain. And the power per liter might be very low. It might be around 15 or 20 watts. So ideally, you want to be somewhere around at least 30, preferably around sort of 50 watts per liter ultrasonic cleaning power. Some mix in, if they've got heating element in there, they actually put in the heating element power as part of the ultrasonic power, which is pretty misleading. So they might read 300 watts, but 250 watts of that is the heating element. So there's a lot of, people buy cheap ultrasonics and they end up with a unit that's not going to really maybe do a lot. It would maybe do okay on your jewelry, but it's not going to be doing much on your bicycle chain. The right ultrasonic with the right cleaning agents and degassed will really do a brilliant job of getting into the tiny nooks and crannies and fissures that agitated, solvent bars just won't get to. So it's marginal. This is where you're talking your fully optimized race chains, where you're going for every fraction of a watt. So again, it's not something that 99% of people need to worry about, because you're going to spend a lot of time focusing on cleaning and prepping to get that extra fraction of a watt better versus what you can do just by doing some good cleaning via container baths and doing an immersive lubricant application if you're not waxing. So yeah, it's worth having a bit of a read of that document, because that sort of steps through a bit more of a deep dive on exactly, how to use an ultrasonic if you've got one, what to look for in getting the ultrasonic. Because, the flip side is sometimes people who work at, say, auto parts or auto stores, they use their auto parts cleaner and they can pit their chain metal. So obviously that ultrasonic clean would have completely stripped the low friction coating off the chain and done quite a bit of damage to the surface metal of the chain. So there's... Again, there's the right tool for the job.
I think one of the things that's really, really great about your site too, and I've spent some time on it and some of your YouTube stuff, anybody that wants to get involved in this, you have really great guides. You've got walkthroughs. If you take the time, obviously, Adam, you're like the best guy to learn from. You're really breaking it down. You're really getting into just a ton of stuff. The last question I want to ask is, I think there's a little bit of misconception around some of the immersion type stuff. And I think some of this misconception comes from, because I don't think people properly maintain or have maintained chains when it comes to wet lube either. How often should you be, or how many kilometers, I guess? I guess it all depends on the conditions you're riding into. Let's call it average conditions, not a ton of water. How often do you need to maintain your chain and take it off and re-wax it? Or in even if you look at it from a wet lube perspective, how often should you be maintaining something with your chain?
Yeah, with wet lubes, unfortunately, it's just such an open question, because your lubricant choice plays such a huge factor in that. So I haven't tested as many wet lubricants as I would like yet, because I've sort of been very heavily focused on finding the absolute best lubricants, which has tended to sort of trend towards the immersive waxing in the wax space and chain coating lubricants. But I'm getting to more wet lubricant testing now. And there are some brilliant wet lubricants that, you know, obviously if you're not riding off-road, you're riding on-road, then for a lot of cyclists, these will be a great choice. Because a wet lubricant can be a really excellent choice for a lot of cyclists, because the top ones have a great, you know, treatment lifespan. So, you know, as opposed to, say, for some, it's like, okay, popping my chain off every circa 300, you know, to 600 kilometers of cycling is just simply not going to be for them. They just want a lubricant they can, you know, add, and they're going to get 800 to 1,000 kilometers, you know, of lovely lubrication, and the chain's not becoming so much of a black mess, and the next, you know, treatment that they put on is going to last another 800 to 1,000 kilometers, and they're going to have really, you know, nice low wear rates. So for a lot of cyclists, you know, that's going to be, you know, quite a match for them. It's really just knowing what are those top options. If you've got an average wet lubricant option, honestly, you know, they really have fairly high wear right from the gun, and to try to keep them low friction, because they will attract contamination very quickly by, obviously, the chain is quite wet, so they become a black mess fairly quickly. Yeah, the maintenance levels between something, say, like a Silka Synergetic and just your average meh wet lubricant on the shelf is quite huge. So, yeah, it's really too dependent, I guess, to give a general guide, apart from if it's a real black mess, you should probably clean it and reset it back to not being a black mess. So, use that as a, I guess, as your guide. But,
well, no, that's great, because I think a lot of people think, like, you know, every 10 kilometers you get to, like, you know, reapply the wax, and that's just not the case. So
no.
I'm happy we cleared that up. I want to get into some just general questions too. What is the Adam Karen's special? What do you use on your own stuff?
I'm immersive waxing. I'm one of those people that, as soon as I sort of saw about immersive waxing way back in the day, I was like, to me, that just makes Captain Obvious sense as to why that's so much better, because it's a solid. And every time you put it back in the bath, it's going to reset back, and, you know, nothing's going to beat that. So, yeah, I've been on the immersive waxing personally for, a long time now. And, yeah, that's been a great relief, because my wife's a really good athlete. So it was always me that would be, you know, once a month going out and going through multiple bikes in the household and resetting the drivetrain. I was like, oh, this is not great. And so it was with much joy that switch was all that I hoped it would be and more. Partly led to me sort of going down this path as well. If immersive waxing is not shoot for you're not sure, just I guess one of the things to remember as well is that a popular option these days, especially for off-road cyclists, is that you can use, so lubricants like, say, the Super Secret Drip are designed to work with immersive waxing. So it's quite popular where somebody will, say, do an immersive wax, relubricate with a Super Secret Drip for, say, the next approximately five relubes, and then pop the chain off and do an immersive wax to reset whatever may have started to get in there over those five relubes. So that makes it super, super easy. And that's a great option, obviously, for road cyclists as well. So if I wasn't a 100% immersive waxer, that is what I would be doing next. Failing that, road, I would be on either Silka Synergetic, or there are a couple of other lubricants I've been testing recently, which are testing outstandingly, and I'll be probably looking at stocking. But even I can definitely recommend RevoLubes is a great one, and Rex Black Diamond has been testing extremely well. Really great longevity per treatment, which is something. So there are some great wet lube choices, and even though I haven't got them up on the website yet because we're still finalizing testing, I do have a latest news section where I do update what's happening in the land of low friction, so what we're sort of doing with testing lately and how things are going. So, yeah, so people can sort of stay tuned on those, and they'll see what other products we recommend, even if we don't stock them yet. Yeah, so I would be in the camp of that for the roadside. I would have a really long-lasting per-treatment lubricant that stays, you know, comparatively versus other options, very clean for a very long time. And that's a great option for those that, if you've got a dedicated ergo bike, so some people don't like to go down the immersive wax path if you've got a dedicated ergo bike, because you do get some excess wax flaking, which you don't notice when you're riding off-road, on the road, but you do notice if it's always on your ergo, you'll get a pile of snowflakes underneath the trainer, and also, you know, flakes onto the flywheel, which can melt on and so on. So if I had a dedicated ergo bike, I would probably be using a, you know, long-lasting wet lube, because they're just not going to get, you know, the contamination issues indoors that you have outdoors. So they can be great option.
You also have a retail side. You do all the testing, but are you selling product on your site? How's that work?
Yeah, so the business model that was set up, because testing's pretty difficult to make money from, and so the business model was to test to find the genuine best lubricant options and then stock and recommend those options. So the retail side then basically supports the testing. And also, because you really do need to remove the factory grease if you want to have a good experience with your chain and drivetrain lifespan, literally over 95% of the chains that we sell, the customer will choose to have the chain pre-prepped. So that is having, you know, zero friction cycling, remove the factory grease, and it's, you know, pre-waxed with, say, molten speed wax or hot milled. And from there, because even if they're not going to wax, you can apply any of the top wet lubricants over the top of those prep options. So the hard part's done, because most people just don't want to have to faff around with, you know, removing the factory grease, and then they've got solvent that really they should probably properly dispose of, but often don't, and they feel a bit guilty about that. So that's, I guess, the retail side, where you're selling the top known chains and the top known lubricants, and most often the chains are pre-prepped with a top known lubricant option. But as we've grown, though, the private testing for manufacturers has really stepped up a lot over the last, especially the last sort of 2 to 3 years, which was something I wasn't sure if would happen, but I hoped would happen, that, you know, once, because there's not much in the way or out there proper independent testing for lubricants. So manufacturers that have really put a lot of genuine work and resources into developing a great, you know, lubricant, and they've done extensive, be it sort of field and tribology testing to sort of help back up that, yes, they've got a great lubricant. But again, if they've just got their own testing and marketing, it's going to be the same as everybody else's. So they really, you know, need to have somebody independent assess it and help confirm that, yes, it's a great lubricant. So testing privately for a lot of manufacturers has really grown very strongly. So that side of the business is now absolutely flat out. So and then obviously if they get the result in the zero friction cycling test that they're looking for, then the non-disclosure is torn up and I get to release the data publicly and do a full detail review, and oftentimes then I'll stock that lubricant as well, because I know it's a great lubricant choice and recommendation. Whereas if the testing doesn't go as well as we hope, then the NDA stays in place. And
so our last question, and we've already kind of talked about this, so I'm going to kind of recap. It's our watt point question. And we look at, you know, somebody's an average cyclist, 300 watt FTP, you know, average fitness, standard drivetrain. Standard drivetrain, it sounds like you're saying, is right around maybe 20 watts for the average cyclist, maybe a little lower, maybe 15, 16. But if you optimize your drivetrain, you're getting down into the six and a half range. So you're looking at saving somebody, and let's say it's a, you know, absolute worst case, you're looking at saving somebody between almost 10 to 30 watts just by taking the advice from this episode.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully none of your listeners are in that sort of 40 watt mark. That's going to be reserved for those that never lubricate their chain, and you can hear it a long way away, and their bearings are, you know, they started with cheap bearings and they've never touched them and they've really gone to crap. I think a lot of your, probably your type of audience are probably going to be hopefully around that 15 to 20 watt mark, not worse than that 20 watt mark. And really everything running well is going to be sort of around that, you know, 12-ish watt mark. So I think hopefully for a lot of your readers, listeners, that just making sure everything is running well, getting it from 15 to 20, hopefully keeping it down to around 12 is going to be a good step. Just making sure that you're running a top known lubricant choice and keeping that chain maintained, and just making sure that your bearings are not let run to crap, especially your little free hub bearings, which you see a lot. Then really, to get below that, then you're starting to have to do some, you know, much more in-depth things. So you're really then starting to look at making sure you're having a dedicated race chain and training chain, which is obviously that's a no-brainer I push as well. If you race, you should not be rocking up to a race on the same chain that you've just hammered out your last training block on. You know, nobody at any decent level does that. You're not going to see, you know, Tadej Pogacar or anyone similar rock up to the Tour de France on the same chain that they just hammered out their last 2 months training on. And again, it costs you no more. Like when your training chain should be moved on, then your race chain moves over to be your training chain, and you just buy one new chain as per normal to be your dedicated race chain. So it makes it easy to keep your chain reset and mint in between races. So you're racing on a super low friction chain all the time, and yeah, not rocking up to race on your training chain, which is pretty silly. Bearings wise, it gets obviously a lot trickier. So once you start to look at optimizing your bearings, you know, really you're looking at bearings that have either a low friction or no contact seal, and you know, having a low fill level of a fast grease, and they just flat out take a lot more maintenance than bearings that have some level of contact seal and a sort of more normal level of fill level of grease that's a longer lasting grease. So to start to really save those efficiencies in your bearings, you have to go to some really fast stuff. And the fast bearings really take a lot of maintenance. And so this is where, again, you might see somebody who either has, say, a set of dedicated race wheels and training wheels, which makes it easier to have really fast bearings with time trial grease in those race wheels, because it's easy to keep up with the maintenance on those. Time trial grease in your everyday wheels, just it isn't going to work. That would be an absolute nightmare, and you'll end up ruining your bearings. And so some people, like, I'm lucky enough that, you know, especially say for, you know, road, I've got a dedicated race bike and a training bike. So it really depends on somebody's resources and budget and how seriously they're taking things. So, but yeah, the bearings is a bit trickier, if that makes sense. But
it does. Listen, Adam, I greatly appreciate you coming on the show today. This for me has been a huge learning experience, really breaking things down. I appreciate your patience. Your knack for explaining things is really, really great. Obviously, some of the Aussie humor in there too, and some of the Aussie terms we always love. So appreciate that. Thanks for coming on. I'll be sure to get this one out. And if anybody wants to ask you any questions, I'll add some links to the site where they can get in touch with you. And if they want to do any stuff from the retail store to support you, we'll also make sure we get that out there. So thanks for being on Faster.
No, my pleasure. And just on the retail side, like if you're overseas, because I'm in Australia, so shipping rates out of Australia are pretty horrendous, because we're a ginormous continent with comparatively very little commerce. So yeah, international shipping rates, unfortunately, are not great. So don't feel obligated that, yeah, if you're in Canada or America or, you know, Europe, that, oh, I have to support ZFC by, you know, buying and paying a big shipping cost to get a chain or a bottle of lubricant over to myself. Honestly, I am having a great time being completely flat out on both the private testing side and, you know, the retail side, which is mostly for domestic. Things are zooming along. The best way really that people can support zero friction cycling if you're overseas, honestly, is to literally just share the knowledge of zero friction cycling, because one of the key goals is to try to combat a lot of the really poor information that's pumped out by, you know, there's some pretty big media channels that put out really not great stuff when it comes to chain lubricant, you know, reviews and chain lubricant maintenance in general. And there's a lot of YouTube channels out there that are pumping out stuff that's really just ends very badly for people's drivetrains. And so, yeah, it's really trying to get more people looking to a resource that's going to, you know, give them a really great outcome with their drivetrain and save a ton of, you know, solvent use as well, versus, yeah, other sources of information which are really not great. And we're trying to chip away at that, but that's a pretty long-term project to try to get some of the media sites to do a bit better with regards to what they're putting out on this front. Best thing to do is just share the knowledge, really, and of ZFC's existence, and yeah, look at the site and get the right info and YouTube channel. So, trying to get my
the word.
That'd be great. Trying to get mine up above some of the others that are pumping out terrible stuff. So that'd be awesome. So yeah,
that'd be awesome. Excellent. Well, listen, thanks again, Adam. We appreciate having you on.
Thanks, John.
Thanks for listening to Faster. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it. Leave a review or teach a friend what you learned today. For more great episodes on getting faster, subscribe to this podcast. While you're on your next ride, be kind to one another and ride safe.